Hello, my name is Chip Ling, and you're listening to Totally M. For this week's podcast, we have Dr. Gita Pinsa, who has taken the reins from Patrick Bafuma for this month's EMID podcast series. And she interviewed Dr. Colleen Kelly to talk about a couple of conditions that she is an expert at. And if Dr. Gita Pinsa's voice sounds familiar, it's probably because you may have heard her from other podcasts, including AEM's Early Access podcast. I apologize for my voice, but their voices sound great. But let's go ahead and dive into their content.
Hi, I'm Dr. Gita Pinsa. I'm an associate professor of emergency medicine with the Brown University Emergency Medicine Residency Program. And I had some questions about antibiotics in a couple of GI-related topics. And to answer those questions, I turned to Dr. Colleen Kelly. She's a gastroenterologist with Lifespan Physician Group in Providence, Rhode Island, and...
And I'm an associate professor of medicine at the Brown Warren Alpert School of Medicine.
I had a few questions for her regarding the use of antibiotics in GI bleeding. So, Dr. Kelly, I think that we're pretty good in remembering our PPIs in acute GI bleeding. We think about octreotide in patients who might have variceal bleeding, but one thing that we forget to think about a lot are antibiotics in GI bleeding. Can we start with what scenarios we're supposed to be thinking about antibiotics in patients who present with acute GI bleeding?
Okay. Well, I figure that's our job, you know, as the gastroenterology consultants coming down on the bleed to remember those little things like antibiotics. So anytime you have a patient with cirrhosis who presents with an upper GI bleed, great idea, PPI, octreotide, but starting antibiotics early and broad spectrum antibiotics. And this is people with cirrhosis, whether or not they have ascites. People think of the antibiotics being for SBP prophylaxis, but it's actually for infection prophylaxis overall because they probably have sort of a translocation of bacteria that occurs during a GI bleed. And so they're at risk for bacteremia and other infections as well.
So why did we start doing this? What's the evidence behind it? And just to clarify, this is any GI bleeding in a patient with cirrhosis, not just variceal bleeding, correct?
Correct. So patients with cirrhosis have a really impaired immune system and are at really high risk of infections when they come into the hospital. And when they come in with a GI bleed, there's up to a 50% risk of infection actually during that hospitalization. So, you know, being that infections are so common, a lot of studies have been done to determine whether antibiotics can prevent these infections that occur in the setting of GI bleed and cirrhotics. And we're, it all kind of came together, a large meta-analysis a few years ago. It was like 1,200 patients. And it did confirm that there's about a 20% decrease in overall mortality and about a 60% decrease in infection risk when these patients are treated prophylactically with broad-spectrum antibiotics.
A 20% decrease in mortality is really significant. Does timing matter? Did they work that out?
Well, I mean, we as soon as we think of it, we recommend it. I don't know if the first dose in the emergency room versus the first dose on the floor, but certainly you want to do it within, you know, the first 12 hours of admission. And the reason we say that is about, you know, 13% of these infections happen within the first 24 hours. So, you know, the sooner the better. We usually recommend broad spectrum antibiotics. So a dose of ceftriaxone is a good choice. And, you know, that's given IV, continued for a 7-day period.
Cool. And if they're being discharged before 7 days, obviously you'll just continue that as PO antibiotics at home?
We can't send them home on ceftriaxone, so we usually switch them to Cipro to complete the 7-day course. If they're taking PO in the hospital, you know, you can switch them to Cipro sooner than that.
Okay, so it sounds like any infection is possible, generalized sepsis is possible, but is there one infection you worry about more than others?
Well, the one infection that we really think about all the time in cirrhotics, and we should, is SBP. And that's because people can come in with no symptoms at all and have SBP. So that's one of the reasons that we're always saying, please send a diagnostic tap on any patient with cirrhosis and ascites who's admitted to the hospital. Just as they come in, do a diagnostic tap. And a good percentage of them, you're going to find SBP.
Wait, hold on. Even in patients that don't have abdominal pain or fever?
Correct. I guess if, you know, they come in, you get a splinter out of their finger or like, you know.
Like, let's say I was admitting that person for a cardiac condition. I would not be doing a tap on that patient.
Well, yeah, but we would ask when they consult us to come see the patient, anytime we see someone with, like, you know, kind of a tense amount of ascites, you don't have to chase around every little pocket of fluid with a needle. But if someone has a good amount of ascites, it's easy to just send off a cell count, you know, send off a cell count and a culture when they come in, and you'd be surprised, you know, like 10% of these people might have SBP without really coming in as that, with that as their primary chief complaint. And, you know, the symptoms can be just very vague. You know, a lot of these patients are encephalopathic and, you know, maybe not complaining of things. But so even outside of the GI bleed setting, you got to have a high threshold for SBP. And then with the GI bleeds, and this is actually a mistake sometimes early fellows make, they assume that you only need to give antibiotic prophylaxis in the bleed setting when it's a cirrhotic with ascites, because everybody's thinking so much about SBP. And we have to tell them, no, it doesn't matter if they have ascites or not. If they have cirrhosis and they come in with an upper GI bleed, whether it's from varices or a peptic ulcer, you give the antibiotics because it's these other infections that, you know, we're also preventing.
So these are some interesting considerations. I had not thought about some of these things. And the mortality of SBP is so high, it's definitely something that we don't want to miss. So is the rationale, if they're asymptomatic, but you find that they have SBP, that they're going to get sick for it, so you go ahead and treat it? It's not like asymptomatic pyuria?
Yeah. I mean, it's SBP, it's treated. You know, these guys who come in and they're diuretic refractory and you just end up having to do these serial paracentesis and you're taking like 6 or 7 liters of fluid out of them like a week, you know, we always would send off a cell count with that when we, you know, when we stick and take the fluid. And sometimes you're surprised, you get it back and it has, you know, all these polys and something's brewing, you know.
Okay, so bottom line, we give broad-spectrum antibiotics to any patient with cirrhosis with or without ascites who presents with upper GI bleeding, whether they have ulcer disease or varices. They all have a generalized risk of sepsis, maybe SBP if they have ascites, but other infections as well. And there's a 20% mortality reduction overall in patients who are treated with antibiotics early. I'm guessing that with that mortality benefit, that it probably does more than the PPI that we actually usually remember.
Oh, definitely.
Okay, now I want to change directions for 1 second, as long as we're talking about antibiotics and GI-related things, because you are one of the world's foremost experts on C. diff infections. So I want to ask you a few questions about antibiotic management in C. diff, what the current thoughts are, and what your thoughts are about treatment in recurrent disease, treatment in severe disease, who's considered an outpatient failure, you know, after how long of antibiotics do we consider them a vanco failure? So let's just say, what do we do for a young person comes in with profuse watery diarrhea after antibiotics and we get a pretty quick turnaround on their C. diff PCR and it's positive? What do I do?
It's good that you're keeping it in mind. Even we know now about a third of cases are community acquired, and I'm seeing patients now who don't even remember getting antibiotics for anything before their C. diff, which is pretty scary. This is kind of a new phenomenon over the last 10 years where we're seeing more of these cases. But if you know, you're making the diagnosis, the most recent IDSA guidelines that came out in 2017 now discourage metronidazole. We previously used that first line, and one of the main reasons is that there's about a 30% resistance to metronidazole in some centers. So they've kind of taken it out of the guidelines altogether. I think if you're talking a very healthy young patient with no comorbidities and a mild case, and, you know, you're really kind of up against a wall because we know vancomycin is expensive and Flagyl is much cheaper, you could probably give a course of Flagyl, but let the patient know that if they're not turning around within a couple of days or if they're getting worse, they would need to, you know, come back. But for everyone else, anyone coming into the hospital, elderly, you know, comorbidities, you want to skip the metronidazole altogether and start with vancomycin.
Okay, and that's 125 milligrams 4 times a day for 10 to 14 days. Fantastic. And then what do you do with the patient who either doesn't get better or gets better briefly and then relapses after they're done? do you, when they come back, do you have to admit them to the hospital? What do you do after that?
So two different scenarios there. One, if you're starting them on vancomycin and they come back, you're not going to see an instantaneous response. Give it maybe 4 to 5 days before things are sort of really firming up and feeling good. But they certainly shouldn't be getting worse. And by 4 or 5 days, they should have some response. If they're not responding, definitely they should, I would admit that patient. It's usually the more severe cases where they're just not responding to vancomycin at all. And you might see a high white count by that time with all the diarrhea they've been having. You're going to see the creatinine bump and other kind of parameters for severe C. diff. And, I think all severe C. diff certainly needs to be admitted. We're talking, it's like a 15% mortality for severe C. diff infection. So that's more of an inpatient thing. What you're seeing a lot now, though, are these recurrent episodes where people get better on the vancomycin, but then within a couple of days to weeks of stopping the vancomycin, the diarrhea recurs, they're again C. diff positive, they relapse, and this cycle of recurrences starts up. And that's becoming, a really big problem. That's actually in the last 10 years gone up about 200%, this multiply recurrent C. diff. And once someone's had one recurrence, they're at greater odds of subsequent recurrences. So you got about a 20 to 30% chance it's going to recur after a first course of antibiotics. And then once you've had one recurrence, your odds just go up from there. So if you recurred once, your chance about 40% it's going to come back. If you've recurred twice, it's about 60%. And you see these people that just become vancomycin dependent and they can't stop the vanco. And it's really disabling.
Wow. So that's when do you start considering the fecal transplant?
So we used to kind of think it was this thing of last resort, and you had to try everything and put people on multiple vancomycin tapers and try everything under the sun before you went to FMT. But given all the data we have now about how effective it is, and it's 85 to 90% effective after one dose. So now that we in a lot of bigger cities, most places, the FMT centers used to be kind of few and far between. There was a long time I was the only person in New England doing it. Now, most major hospitals have someone who's taken it up and is your sort of FMT person. So we don't, we're getting these patients sooner in that cycle of infection. So I'll usually offer it if people have had, three episodes. So that would be two recurrences, three total episodes. I'll offer FMT. If they've had two episodes that were really severe, where they were in the hospital or, kind of took a long time to get over it, or it really like wiped them out and they're maybe have a lot of comorbidities or they're older, we'll offer it sooner. So I'll offer it after that, that second episode or that first recurrence.
So not that we'll ever actually be doing this in the emergency department, but I'm just really curious, like how does it work? What's the actual procedure? You get stool from donors and then you screen it. And then, how do you do it?
So the kind of like FMT 101, it's like identify a donor and screen them. And for the first maybe 7 years I was doing this, I was just asking patients to bring in a family member or a friend who was healthy, clean living. We'd make sure that they didn't have any real, that they didn't have any bad habits that would put them at risk. And we'd check them for, HIV, viral hepatitis, syphilis, and we'd send some stool cultures and then do it. But that's really evolved now. And now the amount of donor testing that's recommended has grown quite a bit. And it's difficult sometimes to even find donors who qualify because the criteria have become so stringent. We're rejecting donors who have really any medical problems, including obesity, anyone who's on any kind of antidepressant medicines, any comorbidities whatsoever. So you have to find this perfectly healthy person and then do a ton of testing on them that can be quite expensive. So most people in the U.S. have shifted to using stool banks. So we have this for blood. Why not for stool? And the largest one in operation is Open Biome. They're up near Boston. And they basically just kind of centralize that whole process of finding donors and screening them. They do a very good job from the very beginning. They've been really intense in their donor screening. They reject about 97% of potential donors that come to them. So really, it's the cream of the crop. Wow. And then they can really kind of have an economy of scale. So they can do really extensive testing, including testing for multi-drug resistant organisms and, other things. then they have a donor who qualifies give a stool every day for, you know, a week or two. So they get multiple treatment doses out of each, out of each donor. But they then process this and, basically homogenize it into saline and, you know, put some glycerol in it and freeze it. And then it's shipped out to centers to, you know, we keep it in a freezer. And then when we're ready to use it, we can thaw it out in a warm water bath in 10 or 15 minutes and use it. And it's just a lot easier. The material's right there. You know, it comes from a safe source. They're now sending out about 10,000 doses a year.
Wow. Wow. That's a lot. And then you, you put it in by a colonoscopy. Does it have to be colonoscopy or can you do sigmoidoscopy or?
So like the first randomized controlled trial that got everybody real excited about this, it was given by nasoduodenal tube. It's actually a Dutch study. And they gave about 500 cc's of fecal material in saline through an ND tube. And people, first of all, people hate having nasogastric tubes, nasoenteric tubes more than they hate a colonoscopy. So, but also we're concerned about aspiration risk when you're putting that much stool down into someone's stomach or intestine. And there have been fatal aspiration pneumonias from FMT done by upper GI tract. So I really don't do it that way. I do mine by colonoscopy because I think sometimes there's an advantage just to doing a diagnostic colonoscopy for this chronic diarrhea to see if there's any underlying IBD or anything else going on. And I have found that. It's also probably more effective. You know, there's very few studies that compare all these methods head to head, but most of the colonoscopy trials you're seeing above 90% with a single dose. So it appears to be more effective. We give it by enema. And so you don't have to be a gastroenterologist to do it. You know, anybody can give an enema. The problem with the enema is especially in older people who may not have the best sphincter tone, you know, it's in there, or people having diarrhea, it's hard to hold that in. So sometimes you have to do two or three doses by enema to get the same effect that you would get from a colonoscopic administration.
So maybe someday that is something we could do in the emergency department.
Yeah, like you need more things to do in the emergency department.
Not that we love giving enemas in the emergency department.
Yeah, I'll give you, I'll be like, okay, after you tap that asymptomatic person for SBP, I want you to go do a FMT by enema in that other person. So, yeah.
Oh, and we're going to love you for it. Well, thank you so much for your expertise. I really appreciate your time. And it was really nice talking to you.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, thank you so much, Dr. Gita Pinsa and Dr. Colleen Kelly for coming on and doing such a great podcast. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.